Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Hester Musson about her historical novel, The Beholders. Hester grew up in Leicestershire. She studied English literature at Bristol University and also has a master's in drama. While pursuing an acting career, her day jobs included working in TV as a freelance auto cue operator. She currently writes for Art Fund, the National Charity for Art, and its magazine, Art Quarterly, and blogs for Nature Conservation. In this episode, we discuss the challenges of writing in a diary form, how to transform one-dimensional characters, and the crushing story of how Hester thought she was going to be published with a different novel, but it sold only to Italian publishers and was then dropped completely. Awful. I'm sure many people will empathise with Hester's story. But before we hear that, here's Hester with an excerpt from The Beholders.
Take this. The master broke off gazing at me and wafted a hand at the machine. It's a steel and flint mill, used by miners in the last century to provide light while they worked. The naked flame of a candle was too dangerous with the gases below ground. He opened the shallow drawer in the table and took out the lump of flint. Let me show you. Close those curtains. There are windows either end of the library. He walked briskly towards one, and, bewildered, I hurried to pull the drapes opposite. The library was plunged into gloom. Now, come closer. We met in the middle, either side of the table. He picked up the mill and held it with one end pressed against his body. I could make out the handle on the wheel closest to him. He turned it, and immediately sparks flew up in the air, blasting the area between us with light. There was a frantic grating sound, and I saw that his other hand was holding the piece of flint against the turning disc. His face, lit up and floating behind the streaming sparks, made me think of a line from Paradise Lost that Mrs. B read to us, with head uplift above the wave and eyes that sparkling blazed. He was grinning like a schoolboy, his lips and teeth strangely magnified in the burning light. I found my own face rigidly drawing itself up into a smile too, as if some bolt of energy had passed from him to me. He let out a shout of a laugh, and the mill whirred to a stop, which, after the bright light, cloaked us in almost total darkness. I blinked. The sudden blindness and silence made the hairs on my arm stand on end. Something moved in the dark, I thought, and I stumbled back towards the window, groping for the curtains. Daylight rushed in. Very effective, you see. The master tossed the flint back into its drawer. But still not very safe. This particular flint mill caused an explosion that killed a miner. He placed it carefully, almost lovingly, back on the table. But the man operating the mill itself survived. Interesting, isn't it? I moved slowly back into the room as he continued. They say the sparks change colour as the methane levels rise. He would have seen what was coming for a brief moment. I expect it was rather beautiful. I looked at the thing. It was awful now, like the beautiful paintings of death and horror. But also, it was true. Interesting.
Hi, Hester. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Beholders.
Hello, and thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
So can you start, Hester, by telling us what The Beholders is all about?
Yes, so it's set in 1878 and it begins with the trial of a woman who is the wife of an MP and she's accused of murdering their baby son. But then the story flips back a few months and it's told completely through the diaries of a housemaid called Harriet Watkins. She goes to work for them at their estate in Hertfordshire. And she is running away from her own difficult life choices, really. She's got the option of going home and marrying her childhood sweetheart, which is the most sensible thing for her to do, but she doesn't want to do it. Or an independent life, but a very hard life in domestic service. But she thinks she has a bigger purpose in life, and she thinks that she's found it through working at this house, which is extraordinary, where even the other servants are all beautiful. And through working with Clara Gethin, her mistress, who is captivating and seems to see something in Harriet that no one else does. But she also realizes that something is wrong. It's not all quite as sparkly as it seems. And as she begins to understand what's actually going on in the hall, she starts to doubt her decision. And eventually, she has to make another choice and really decide how far she's willing to go and what she's willing to risk. Are willing to risk in order to do the right thing or what she thinks is the right thing.
Yeah, and I wondered whether you could give us kind of a bit of a background of where this novel began life. In fact, when I started reading it, I wondered whether it was there was some basis in a true story, or I was just kind of intrigued as to where it all began.
It's not actually based on a particular true story at all. There are several factors that came together. But it has a very strange origin, really, because I didn't, it's not the book I sat down to write whatsoever. That was going to be a tale in the present about a woman whose life had stalled. And I mean, she's also looking for meaning. So it's sort of similar themes. But she sort of sets out on a quest to discover a mystery about an ancestor. So I was going to have her as the main story and then just dropped in little diary extracts, which explains to the reader what was going on, but she doesn't find the diary until the very end of the book. But I started writing the diary extracts first, and that completely took over. And I started writing Harriet, and her voice just eventually took off, and I couldn't get her to shut up. So I ended up by accident writing a historical novel. And I think just doing research around that time, and you inevitably you set a novel, especially with female protagonists in the 19th century, and you come slap bang up against the problems they had, the oppression and the abuse and the abuse of power over them, and the lack of rights. And and just reading around that, there were just so many instances, but there wasn't one thing that I thought I would base it on. My agent actually, when she read it, she said, "Oh, you must have based it on, I can't remember the name of the man, but there was a court case, which was sort of similar. It had definite themes, which I hadn't understood, hadn't known about at all. But actually, it wasn't. But I was kind of glad to have found out about that. Like, yes, validated."
I'm intrigued then. So you just kind of started writing these diary entries and Harriet appeared. How did you go from that to this story? Did you just kind of keep writing in Harriet's voice and find out the kind of the secrets through her? How did it work?
I had the overarching backstory subplot in mind, possibly more than I'd had the actual what was going to be the main plot. So I knew which bits of that story I wanted to have diary entries for. But once I started writing it, and once I realised that actually this was just too big a story, it was a novel all in itself, then I still did have that framework. But again, that changed because once I started writing Harriet, the original plan was to get her out of the house, get her out of Finton Hall really quite quickly. And then there was going to be this other story arc outside of the house. But I couldn't get her to leave because she kept finding out new things and being really interested in stuff. And I kept writing in my journal, sort of around October time. I was like, I will have them out of the house by November. I will have them out of the house by Christmas. And it just never happened. Until much, much later in the book. So then it was kind of interesting. For a lot of this book, I had no idea what I was writing, and I've not had that experience before. It was quite unnerving, but also quite exciting.
There's a great quote in your acknowledgements where you say, debut novels aren't always the same as first novels, and this book owes so much to its two predecessors. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about that. I'm assuming you've kind of written other novels before and they haven't maybe gone anywhere, or you've struggled with them. How, tell us about kind of your background to getting to this point.
Yeah, with the first two books, they were completely different. The first one was really a time travel story, but it did have its, it was about a physicist who, very randomly and without explanation, is sort of zapped forwards to the present from the late 19th century. So there was a lot of research into the 19th century then, and I've always been interested in the Victorian period. And then the second novel, that was an absolute, I just sort of ran at it. I had no idea what I was doing. Didn't really believe I could write a novel. That was kind of astounded I ever finished it. And then, but writing that made me realize that that was actually what I wanted to do. And I just sort of pivoted my entire life around writing then. And then the second novel, which I took much more seriously, thought, okay, I can do it. Maybe I do have a shot at this. That was a modern psychological thriller, really. And that got me my agent, and that was a very different experience writing that because I felt a bit more confident and I planned that one more. And thought, okay, yeah, I'm really learning now how to do this, what you're supposed to do. And that one did actually did that did sell to an Italian publisher. But then they shelved it, which was a thing I didn't realize happened, but apparently it's quite common. The editor who bought it left and they had a shake up and my book just got shelved. But you don't get told that.
Yeah.
You do, I had to sort of say, nothing's happened for a long time. Well, you know, it's something, and yeah, it turned out that they just decided to drop it, which was really disappointing at the time. But actually worked out brilliantly because I still got paid some money, which really helped during lockdown. Because I'd sort of fallen through the cracks in terms of having an income. And so really helped sort of fund the writing of this one. And then this one can come out as a debut with all the sort of bells and whistles around that, which if the Italian one had been published, wouldn't have been able to.
It's quite a change then from writing a kind of contemporary psychological thriller to then writing this historical fiction, and kind of gothic fiction. But I get the sense that you almost feel it took you that time to find your way into the right voice and the right genre for you, and then now you feel like you've grasped it with the beholders. Is that kind of what you think's happened?
I'm not sure actually, because I feel kind of wedded to those other books as to this one. Yeah, it's strange because this is obviously the one that's taken off and is obviously just what we all do. We do our best, and we write what we want to write, and you just hope that's going to align with the stars and with the publishing marketplace and with the editor it lands in front of. You just don't know. And although yes, it is a very different book and it's a very different genre, the experience of writing it, I feel, is kind of the same. It's still the same process. You're not treating your characters any differently. The difference is the research that needs to go into it and the extra work that needs to go into to feel your way into the life of a character and understanding, you know, just what the floor feels like when they get out of bed and, you know, what are they eating and all those little details which you just have to know to bring it off the page. That was the difference with it. It's just a shed load more reading around it, which is really interesting and fun, but sometimes I think, oh, to go back to contemporary.
Can you pinpoint maybe that you think there's something special about this book that grabbed the attention of the editors that bought it? Is there something different about this book, do you think?
Gosh, that's a question. I feel like you need to ask them that. Maybe I should ask them that. I think they really like the voice of Harriet. I think that really worked. And I think Gothic historical fiction is just a big thing. I don't know if it's always been, but I think certainly at the moment. And I think there are, I mean, it is certainly set in its time, but there are parallels. With the present and the issues that, you know, sort of explored in the book definitely resonate still. I think that's why the Victorian period is such a rich theme for writers and so often set there. I think those two things, the sort of voice and just where you're able to do what I was able to explore in it, I think perhaps helped. And it's really, because everyone loves Victorian fiction as well. I mean, a lot of people love reading books from the 19th, written in the 19th century. And so to write a sort of similar sort of thing, but writing now, you can obviously write about things which the Victorians couldn't write about or are unwilling to write about. So that always adds another element of interest as well.
Definitely. One thing that I wanted to speak to you about is the kind of the use of your prologue, which is this piece from the newspaper. And I wondered whether you'd always thought of using a prologue to kind of, I've got a prologue in my book, and I guess it was a way of signposting that, you know, something is going to happen later on that's going to be exciting or controversial or whatever it is. Did you always think of having a prologue, or was that a later decision?
I think it was quite late in the writing my own draft, first draft, quite a late decision then. I didn't realise how powerful it was going to be, but when I showed it to a friend who read it, and as she was reading it, she said, oh, it's really, you just really want to know what happened because of what's in the prologue. And I thought, oh, that made me realise, oh, that's actually quite a neat trick.
Tell us a little bit more about Harriet then. Obviously, we find her at the beginning with this dilemma of, you know, she's getting letters from her mother that are quite kind of guilt tripping, and she's got a sweetheart. How did you, obviously you had her voice that came to you straight away in this diary form. How did you then go about kind of building her as a fully rounded person with kind of creating her personality?
I think I was very much led by the voice. There is that was a strange, sort of weird, spooky thing of feeling like characters are behaving by themselves. You just sort of turn up and they'd show you what's happening. And I think that got more and more layered the more that happens and the more that she sees, and just thinking about how she would respond to something. And as things get more and more weird, moving away from things, I suppose, that where I was writing her, things that I would be familiar with, like, you know, being bored of a relationship, not wanting to be in it, or feeling very frustrated at work and feeling like you don't have any options. And obviously my life isn't the same as the 19th century housemaids, but there are parallels with that. So you sort of start from yourself, I think, but using her voice, and then that just layers and layers as the plot starts to thicken and as more things happen. Her character has to have an impact on that story. So I think it sort of happens organically that way, of just figuring out what this character would do, or not even figuring it out, just letting her do it, and then sort of saying, oh, okay, so this is who she is, and this is how you can develop this part of her character. And yeah.
So this book, kind of thing. I'm getting the sense this book wasn't as planned as maybe previous books had been.
No, it was, well, it was, but then it just went in a completely different direction. It was very strange. I've never been pushed around by a story so much. I just couldn't get it to behave the way I wanted it to. So I had to keep going back and replotting and saying, okay, so it is just the historical novel, and then it's okay, so they're just going to be in the house for a lot longer, and the structure has to change, and I have to either compress or do away with the other story I was thinking about. So yeah, I did try to plan it, but it wouldn't let me. Yeah, strange experience.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
What do you think then was the most challenging aspect of this book to write?
I think because I wasn't writing exactly what I had wanted to write, I found that quite difficult because I didn't want, although there is a big theme of power and the abuse of power in the book, I'm not very interested in villains and, you know, like real life, like real people villains, even well-rounded character villains. Yeah, I'm just not that interested in why people who are in that position do what they do. Although obviously it can be very interesting. Other people have dealt with that. I just didn't particularly want to. I wanted to look more at what the people do beneath that and how they're affected by it. So I found that, you know, this one character in particular that I hadn't really planned on making a central character, and then I had to, and I found that really difficult. He was quite one-dimensional to begin with, because I just wasn't really interested in him. and I thought, well, I'm going to have to make him interesting to me. So I sort of, yeah, did more with his character, but it was, I kind of resented having to do it. And although I'm quite pleased with the end result, it was a slightly strange, it was like the patriarchy infiltrated my novel.
Yeah, like you said, it's hard. I've spoken to a lot of historical fiction writers, and it's that balance between telling a story that's appealing to kind of our contemporary sensibilities in terms of quite feminist novels or novels where women have agency, but also working within the constraints of the patriarchy and that kind of historical level of, well, historical lack of control that women have in that era. I just want to ask you a little bit more about your research, because obviously you've done some research for the Victorian era before and you have an interest in that time. Was most of your research done before you started writing, or did you kind of dip in and out while you were writing the book?
I did an initial 3 months where I was really researching the servant experience because I didn't have any real detail on that. Doing a lot of reading, trying to get as many primary sources as possible. And then when I started writing, it inevitably continued because I was suddenly in a situation which I hadn't researched, because the story takes you where it will. And just things like the language, especially doing it first person in diary form, it feels like every other word I'm looking up the etymology and was it used then and is this idiom in place? And sometimes it was so frustrating. I can't have her stick her heels in. Oh. so it continued, and yeah, all the way through, and even afterwards I was still going back and checking stuff and trying to figure out a better example for something small and that kind of thing. Yeah, it never stopped.
Was there a point with the language that you just thought, I'm giving up, in a sense, I'm kind of letting go of that responsibility, that it has to be perfect?
No, I never felt that. And there was one point in edits where my editor said, you know, I was really angsting over a word. And she was like, oh, don't worry, you know, we'll do that in the copy edit. You know? I mean, what a lovely position to be in. I was grateful for the line and copy edits. But I didn't lose that sense of responsibility. And I'm sure there are absolutely bound to be 100 mistakes in there and more. But yeah, also just because to make that as authentic as possible just feels like you're saying as near as possible to the character that you want to write. I did want to write something that did feel plausible. There's obviously a certain amount of artifice that goes into it. I mean, nobody writes a novel, a diary like Harriet does in my novels. No one does that. But I did want to feel as much as possible like she could have been a 19th century girl.
I think as well, the diary form is so synonymous with Gothic fiction. So it works really well because you're giving us like a first person perspective. And sometimes I think, well, this is another thing that we will agonize over. How can you give a first person perspective? Is it going to be diary, a letter? Are they just going to be talking to the reader? You know, all those things that you have to consider. But luckily for you, your diary works in that kind of era really well, I think.
Yeah, I think it really did lend itself. And I did think, oh, maybe it doesn't have to be a diary when I knew I was doing the whole book. Maybe it could be letters. I could play around with it. And I think if I'd known how difficult it was going to be actually to try and sustain an entire novel in diary form, I might have changed my mind about it because it was really challenging. Mm. But I'm glad I stuck with it and did it because it is, yeah, it's so of the time.
Definitely. I'd love to kind of step back in time a little bit. And you mentioned earlier that there was a point where you were writing, I think, your second novel where you thought, okay, I can do this. Like, this is possible. I wondered whether there was a point in your life where you thought, you know, I love writing, I want to be a writer, and now I'm going to take it seriously. Was there a point that you had that?
Yeah, definitely. I think I put off writing for a long time because I was an actress to begin with. And I'm wondering, I was talking to a friend about it the other day, if I just actually mistook something when I was 9 and my mum took me to the theatre and we saw 2 shows, Shakespeare's, and I was absolutely blown away by it. And I sort of absorbed somehow some of the lines and then was apparently repeating them for weeks afterwards. And I took from that, oh, I want to be on stage, I want to be an actor. But I wonder if actually I love language, I want to write, should have been what I thought. I mean, I don't regret doing the acting at all. It was brilliant. But I think that sort of delayed the writing because I went off to do an English literature degree. So it's like, you know, the clues were there. It was all about the books. But I think in a way, although I absolutely love that, I think writing, reading such incredible authors in depth over a long time does make you a bit shy of writing yourself, even if it's not a conscious thing. I thought, oh, I'd like to write, but you know, I don't have the stories coming to me. I can't write like this. I never really examined it very much, but it meant that I didn't try. And also I thought, oh, I want to be an actor. Mm-hmm. And so that was for my 20s. And then as that was sort of grinding to a halt, it was the very familiar, sorry story of the aspiring actor. Not much to write home about, but, you know, good experience anyway. But I was actually thinking, oh, thinking the unthinkable, I should just stop acting. And I'd had an idea for a story for ages. And then I ended up very uncharacteristically turning up to an airport 5 hours before I needed to be there. Don't know how I managed to do that. And there was no point going back into town. So I thought, oh, well, I'll start writing this story. And doing that story, even that first day writing, just lit something in me. And it made me realize that, yeah, this is what I want to do. And I went straight from that story. It was supposed to be a short story, but it was about 13,000 words in the end, which isn't that short. Not very good at the short form. I went straight from that into the first novel. So yeah, it was definitely a kind of moment of epiphany.
Did you query with that first novel? Did you send it to agents or not?
Yes, I did. I sent it to one batch. I think I knew deep down that it wasn't going to fly. And I went to a Curtis Brown Discovery Day, and for a moment it was all really exciting. The agent was like, "Oh, send me the whole novel immediately. This sounds amazing." And then I got this really quite brutal email sort of saying it was, unpublishable, really. So that was a shock, but I was just already on that thing. I think I don't know if I did try a rewrite then. I have gone back to that novel several times, and I still stand by it. But someday, even if I just put it on the internet in a Word document, I'm gonna get it out there. But yeah, I did. But I think I was much more, the second novel felt much more to me like, okay, this is ready. And it still took a very long time to get an agent. I did it in batches, and it took forever. And Juliet was the very last agent on the last batch who had asked for the whole manuscript. Yeah, I mean, it took a long, long time and a lot of submissions, but got there.
Yeah, kind of a long emotional process, I can imagine as well.
Mm.
So we often talk about kind of the debut year and the kind of ups and downs of being a debut novelist, and particularly I think when you sign the contract, you've no idea what the next kind of 18 months are going to feel like, because there are things that happen that are out of your control, or there's things that you maybe think, oh, I'm not sure about that, or I don't know what I'm doing. Is there anything you wish you'd known kind of when you before you signed your contract that would maybe help you deal better with all the ups and downs of being a debut?
I'm not sure there isn't. I mean, I think I'd like to have just been told more what to expect, because I think publishing is obviously this machine that's going on, and everyone in it forgets that everyone coming into it has no idea what's happening. So maybe just slightly more preparation. But it's not like I had no preparation at all, and I could always ask for more. But I think because it was my third book, and I'd almost got to that point of, I did actually have to sort of have a word with myself. I'd be like, well, are you gonna, if this book doesn't fly, what are you gonna do? And the answer was just so clearly from experience, well, I'm just gonna keep writing. So I had to really look at the fact that maybe I'm just gonna keep writing and not get published. And I'm just gonna have to be okay with that because I want to write full stop. So I think it's not that it's a bonus, but because I felt at peace with that, everything that I don't feel as worried or stressed about what happens now. Whereas I think if this had happened with either of the other two books, I'd be much more stressed and anxious and worried about what's going on, and am I doing all everything I can, and what's happening with the publisher, and blah, blah, blah. I think it would have been a much more sort of stressy experience. Whereas I think I'm quite lucky in a way. My younger self would look at me with utter disgust, but that I am, this is happening in my mid-40s. So I just feel a bit more relaxed about it and a bit more able to enjoy it. So yeah, I think if it was my younger self doing it, I would just be like, just relax, ask the questions, but and enjoy it. This is, this is such a, we all know how much is down to luck and chance and all the rest of it. Don't stress.
Would you say
Enjoy
as
everything
well,
that comes.
kind of just to put all the publishing stuff to one side and just concentrate on the writing of another
Yes.
book or the next thing? Yeah.
Exactly. Remember why you're doing it in the first place. And I think for most people, it is the writing. Yeah, I don't think many people can go into it just, with wanting fame and fortune.
No, exactly.
Good luck to them if they do, but what a thing to choose.
So on that note, finally, Hester, I was wondering if you could give us a little tease about what you're writing at the moment.
Oh, well, that's it's still, I'm stuck with the Gothic 19th century whole era, but that is, it's about a woman who is brought up in a spiritualist medium's household, who she believes is her mother. She doesn't know her, this woman won't actually tell her. And she sort of made she sort of made put to work to, as all the behind the scenes, because this woman She treats it as a business, and a lot of it is fake, even though she claims to have real clairvoyance. So my main character is sort of appalled by it all, and she's basically abused. It's a very abusive childhood, and she breaks out in the end, and she manages to find a life working with and as much as she could as a woman, an archaeologist. And she thinks she's sort of broken free, and she's, you know, there's that whole Victorian pull between sort of modern science and religion and folklore and all that sort of thing. But it turns out, of course, that she hasn't quite escaped it. There's stuff going on at the dig she's working on where the, you know, locals believe it's cursed. And she finds out that her guardian or mother, whatever she is, has gone missing, but has left her a letter, which seems to have a connection to the dig. So she's off on another mystery.
Oh, well, it sounds great. And it sounds like you've done so much work in terms of plotting the story already. So that sounds brilliant. Hester, yeah. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you very much. It's been really fun. Thanks.
That was Hester Musson talking about her historical novel, The Beholders, which is out on the 18th of January and available to pre-order now. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.